Welcome to The Reserve, a news and thoughts podcast from the Centralverse. I'm your host, Caleb Nygaard, and today is episode number 36. Fed communication is always challenging. It always has its moments, and there has been a lot of evolution in Fed communication and financial crisis communication in general in the last couple of decades. But it's tough, and it has interesting trade-offs during regular times, also financial crisis times, and then now in inflation times, which we haven't seen in a few decades as well. And so I'm really excited to have Tony Fratto, founding partner at Hamilton Place Strategies and former White House Deputy Press Secretary and Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury on the show today to talk about some of this. Tony, good to have you.
Hey, Caleb. Thanks for having me on. I love the podcast. It's great to be a guest on it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I want to we're going to go broad to narrow and then back out broad at the end. But I wanted to start by getting some of your reactions about communication under the Powell Fed. And I want to put a pin in this just kind of context. I've been reading Bernanke's new book, and he makes a very interesting like word choice, and that he always, whatever era he's talking about, he calls it the Fed chair and then Fed. Like, it's never just the Fed, or it's never just, it's always the Yellen Fed or the Powell Fed, or, you know, the Volcker Fed. And so it's just this very, it's always, you know, very much in that. And I think there is a communication aspect to that. So talking about the Powell Fed,
talk about Van Halen the same way, you know, I mean, there's right.
That's exactly.
We're talking about rock bands that way too.
That's exactly.
Well, that's it. Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I mean, look, I mean, no one knows more than Ben, and has thought about more about the you know, communications of the Fed over the decades and the evolution of communication, how much important it is, how much communication is it is policymaking, right? It is you know, right? It's through words. And he was a big, not just advocate, but practitioner of implementing communications reforms at the Fed. And, you know, I'm old enough to remember when, if you watched CNBC on FOMC day, they had they'd have a camera out on the sidewalk to video Chairman Greenspan walking into the Fed. And, you know, whether his briefcase was stuffed with papers or thin gave some indication as to whether, you know, what the Fed was going to announce that day. But we sort of went to these crude understandings. But there was also a time when they didn't announce, you know, they just carried out open market operations with little to no communication to the market. So it was a really complete disregard for the powerful tool of communicating to market participants. So that's evolved, you know, quite a bit over time. And Bernanke, as a student and researcher of it, I think had a really good sense of why it was important. Not just from a, you know, obviously there's a good governance piece of it too, right? There is an obligation for your government agencies to tell you what they're up to. You know, just tell you what they're thinking and what they're seeing. And so there is some obligation to that. There's also just, you know, just in terms of signaling what your goals are, what your observations are, that the markets will do your work for you if you tell them some of the same things you're seeing. And I think that was something that on both counts, I think was something that Bernanke really felt, that we should, you know, we should be signaling to the markets what we're seeing, what our expectations are, what our goals are. And we should also be explaining a lot more, because it's not a healthy situation for a government agency to essentially be a black box, right? You know, where, you know, the white puffs of smoke come out of the building and then you go deal with that. It's not good governance. And in the worst of times, you're in a really challenging situation. And so it was ironic that Bernanke was the guy in the worst of times trying to go out and educate the world about what the Fed was doing and what it was trying to do with not much ground cultivated below him, right, in the decades before. So I think it made his job harder. You asked about the Powell Fed. I think he has benefited from a lot of the work that was done to put in place communications, speeding up the release of the minutes, press conferences after every FOMC meeting. There are two schools on this. Maybe there are more schools on this about the communications by Fed governors and regional presidents. Some people think of it as a cacophony.
Yeah,
it can be at times, but I think for people who are paying attention, it's very, very helpful to hear from all of them, whether they're sitting on the FOMC or not. Mm-hmm. It's really important to hear from these guys and what they're seeing and what they're thinking, and let that fill your knowledge base for how to react to the Fed. So I think it's been very good, and I think you used that certainly in the early days of the crisis, it helped to be able to be comfortable going out.
Yeah.
When he went out on March 3rd, which was Super Tuesday.
Yeah.
So it was an inter-meeting rate cut in the face of what the FOMC saw was happening to the economy in a very fast-moving and dynamic situation in response to COVID. And there was a lot of criticism and a lot of lack of understanding.
Absolutely.
Caleb, looking back, the Fed had to take action. And we know that Fed rate cuts, policy rate cuts didn't contribute to creating a vaccine and didn't fix supply chains. But it was obvious, I think, in retrospect, it was obvious that economic support was going to be necessary from all the levers, not just monetary policy, but fiscal policy. And I think that was the case he was making on that day. But what helped was that the Federal Reserve press corps, we're very comfortable in that situation. And Chairman Powell was very comfortable being at the podium, making the announcement and taking questions, which would not have happened 10 years earlier. If that was 10 years earlier, that's not what we would have seen. We would not have seen Chairman Greenspan holding a press conference to announce it in that situation.
Taking questions.
it was a very different, it's having the experience to do it, the comfort level in doing that, even though Powell had not been chairman for that long, but he was in, he had a lot of experience speaking publicly about these issues. And you could see that he was comfortable. And I think we needed comfort in addition with the action. We didn't want to, shock people. We just wanted, I think they wanted to be sure that people understood that the Fed was going to be ready to play its role, was actively playing its role, and I think that helped to nudge fiscal authorities to go play their role as well.
Yeah, and I wanted to follow up on that. And there are other things that we'll come back to, but in the moments of crisis, the Fed is not only it's this interesting, large group of people that each have, like you said, their own place within the organization, but they has a lot of senior people whose voices genuinely do matter. So it's a kind of a big group of people, but then also communicating to a big and diverse group of people as well. If we have at least the general public, who also's decisions are have a direct effect on what the Fed, how successful the Fed is or not. Congress also, especially in moments of crisis, like you just mentioned, and with markets. So, I guess thinking of those weeks and months in, basically late February to at least, early summer 2020, what are your thoughts on how the Fed did, how the Powell Fed did during those times on communications or if maybe not directly a letter grade or anything, what were, having been in many situations like that, what are some things that they were trading off in deciding how to develop a communication strategy?
I think what we saw from the Fed in those first, especially the first 6 months, right? We could talk about the things that the Fed, missed. And we'll get to that, but they deserve enormous credit for the leadership they showed early on in the crisis. And, you and I paid attention to the work that's gone into the Fed and other central banks have done in the wake of the global financial crisis, of thinking about their programs and crisis response and communicating about them as well over the, you know, the decade before COVID. Sure. A lot of work that was done, a lot of thinking and a lot of practice. And I think you just saw that come out when they were announcing programs. There were a lot of mistakes in announcing programs and explaining them in 2008 and 2009, because they were doing things for the first time. Right. They were not doing things for the first time now. And in fact, a lot of the people who are at the Fed today were there during the global financial crisis, and they learned a lot and studied a lot. And I think you were just able to see that the confidence and they had in announcing the, you know, lending support programs, all the things they did to support credit and liquidity in markets. I think I look back on it, I see just a lot of confidence in that what they were doing was going to have the effect that they were looking for, and I think it largely did in a, you know, in a very challenging environment. I also thought they did a pretty good job of educating people about the significant financial and economic impact that we were going to see. And so if you go back to that time, that late February, even just think about what fiscal authorities needed to learn in that period. We went from the earliest discussions were for it's almost funny to talk about right now, but sure. The original, you know, some of the original bills that they were talking about were in the range of $8 billion,
right? Orders of magnitude smaller than
literally orders of magnitude larger very quickly. And I remember there was a 3-day period in March where leader McConnell and others were having this you know, you're publicly talking about what the size of the first CARES Act was going to be, and it literally went from $1 trillion to $2.4 trillion in 3 days.
Yeah.
Now you think about it, right?
Yeah.
And it looks like people said it was like you know, you're going to need a bigger boat and they doubled the size of the boat pretty quickly, and that was a very successful and well-timed fiscal support for the economy. And but in that intervening period, you hear the Fed out there, you know, doing a lot of education about what the economic impact was going to be. And I think they did it with a you know, pretty good authority that people paid attention to and understood the severe economic impacts that were coming, and that they were the kinds of things that only money could solve.
Right. Yep.
For now, until we got to vaccines.
Yeah. What I think the conventional wisdom is that Powell kind of nailed the communication, especially with Congress, you know, that he just over and over again, he probably went out for, there had to be some people inside the Fed and inside Treasury and inside Congress that were made uncomfortable, maybe by the degree to which Powell was kind of beating that drum, but he did it really consistently and probably went far and definitely went farther. Like you said, these Fed chairs kind of stand on each other's shoulders. And so all that he was able to do was because of what Yellen and Bernanke had done before.
That's true. And they're different, you know, I mean, you know, it's Greenspan and, you know, I mean, I don't know whether it helped or hurt to be called maestro and that sort of reputation, but there was a time, and this, I think this hobbled Bernanke during the global financial crisis, the Fed overwhelmingly depended on the relationship that the Fed chairman and in particular Greenspan had with the chairman of committees and leadership in Congress. So Greenspan did not have to have extensive relationships on the Hill. He didn't spend a lot of time going door to door and talking to a lot of members. He would talk to the chairman of the committees quietly. He would talk to leadership quietly. And they would get the things done that they needed to get done. And that was a very different day and age. Congress was more, respectful of the authority of the Fed and confused by a lot of what the Fed did, if we're, you know, being honest, right? Like not rely on a whole lot of understanding. And there's just a lot more attention to everything today. And there was. And so when I say Bernanke was hobbled by that, Bernanke, the Fed as an institution, not just the chairman, but as an institution, didn't have extensive, you know, external affairs, legislative affairs offices. I mean, I was at Treasury Department and we had legislative affairs. The White House had legislative, everybody had legislative affairs. Legislative affairs at the Fed was very thin and very careful to not be seen as political. And by, you know, trying very hard to not be seen as political, just did not have great relationships with members. And so that's a fine line to walk. I don't want, you know, we don't want them to be political at all, but you need to have those relationships. You need to be able to talk to people, teach them, explain them what's going on so that they can then also be your advocates out there as well. And when I say advocates, I mean, just helping to explain why the Fed is doing what it's doing, why Congress is supporting the things that the Fed is doing, or posing it from a position of knowledge, not mythology.
So do you agree that he had that quote early on saying, you know, he was going to wear out the carpets on Capitol Hill? Do you think that that paid off? Do you think it was? I mean, it's all a counterfactual, but was it necessary? And did that actually make a significant difference? I think that it probably did, but I'd love to hear if.
I think it did. I think it actually really helped out. Look, you know, so Chairman was just he was just confirmed for another. Yeah. Yeah. Terms chair in a town that can't agree on anything.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Not only in a town that cannot agree on anything, but in a town where and even beyond the town feels pretty comfortable in laying large amount of blame for inflation, which they're all at risk, political risk for. Absolutely. At the foot of the Fed. Yep. And yet, Jay Powell was successfully confirmed by wide margins for another term, which I think was the right thing to do. I supported him getting another term. I still do, and that doesn't mean that there aren't mistakes that,
sure,
that we have to deal with inflation. But what that does tell me, though, is that the Hill knows him very well.
Yeah.
They know him and they trust him. And he communicates with them, you know, and I think it's appropriate ways. That he communicates very, very well with them, and I think they have a much more information exchange based relationship. That has ever existed before. And I think that's a positive.
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. There were early days in the Fed where, I've gone back through the old annual reports. They were, 300 pages long, and they were really quite juicy. And there was a time for many years where the Fed would include, they would straight up include a section in the annual report that said, Congress, this is what we recommend you change. and they were very, very open about it. And then, but that was in the early before times,
Those were before times. Yeah.
Yeah. We're so far from that. And I think, like you said, there's a sense of democracy and a sense of public accountability and appropriate distance, but accountability on technocratic expertise that kind of gets all thrown in there. One more about the Powell era, kind of looking backwards, and then I want to talk about kind of two tough situations post-pandemic that the Fed has been in. But Trump's attacks on Powell were personal, they were severe. The Fed wasn't unique, obviously, in Trump's falling on Trump's bad side on occasion. But that was also very quite unique in recent history. And, it seems like they handled themselves very well, but I wanted to get your take on that entire, year and a half or so period.
Yeah. I think, there were a lot of norms throughout the Trump presidency that were, broken. And I hope that are being repaired now.
Yeah.
And, things like this, standard that took decades to get to of, the independence of the Fed on monetary policy, right? And allowing the Fed to do its its job. And I do think it's okay for administrations to express themselves, allow the Fed to do its job and to respect its independence. And so that was a norm that was where we saw it on things with the president talking about, you know, trying to jawbone the dollar and you know, a whole range of other norm busting activity from the White House. And I hope that we've, you know, I hope that we've seen that, I don't want to see that ever again. I think it's damaging for the country, and at a time when we really, really need to restore faith in institutions. Yeah. We saw this with the treatment of the CDC and the CDC's failures to communicate well, and others as well. So there's a lot of work to be done to repair it. I was proud of the way the Fed never rose to the bait. Never took the bait, not once, not even in a, I never saw an article by a Fed reporter that said that the Fed was irritated by it or upset by it, or they never gave oxygen to that. And whenever Chairman Powell was asked about it, as I think he was actually even on that day on March 3rd, was asked about the president calling him names, and never rose to the bait to say, made it very clear that we do our work. We do it based on the data and the information that we see and our judgment, and we don't allow anything to influence that, which is exactly the right answer. And it's the consistent answer that he would give. And I would recommend any future Fed governor to give, because it is damaging to the ability of a Fed to do its job. As we've said, we started off talking about earlier, right, is that, I mean, we talk about Fed credibility.
Sure.
That's part of Fed credibility, right? Absolutely. But hopefully that's an anomaly. I hope we don't see that again, and I don't think we will.
Yeah, in many areas we hope that it was an anomaly. But I think that and the Fed and Biden is doing a lot to both shift us back, as well as, you know, like you said, I think the reappointment of Powell alone was a big deal. So I'm talking about the Fed in general, the pandemic, and before we get to inflation, I did want to ask about the trading scandal, because you work with a lot of crisis communications of corporations that are dealing with different scandals and different things. And this, the trading one was, you know, it's not necessarily Fed specific. I mean, it's these types of crises happen. There are probably multiple happening all the time in big companies where leadership makes some dumb decisions, and, you know, whether they're over the line or under the line, both how it looks versus the actual line itself. You know, tell us just a little bit about how you deal with those kinds of, you know, those kinds of situations, and then to the degree that you're comfortable with talking about how Powell and the rest dealt with Kaplan and Rosengren and eventually Clarita. You know, having those
sure.
scandals.
Yeah, and it's, you know, Rich Clarida is a friend of mine as sure. well. And, sure. and I think the world of him, and I don't, yeah. you know, I would just say, just from, you know, my sense of Rich is there was never any intent in the management of his book. That said, you know, this is again one of these legacy, arrangements at the Fed until this Fed changed it was, just even allowing officials to be trading books. And, you know, we don't want to tell people that, you can't be investing your wealth. For some people, a lot of wealth, it's really hard to do.
They don't just have it in an FDIC protected account.
Exactly, right. So you have to do something with it, and the most vanilla thing you can do is put it into U.S. Treasuries and, you know, government agency paper and things like that. And so, something needs to be, you know, you need to allow these individuals to put their wealth somewhere. But it's got to be blind, and I think it's just. The rules for Fed officials were long overdue for reform, and I'm glad that they did it. I know, as you know, the rules for me as a Treasury official,
sure,
were far stricter.
And
I will tell you that, but where I do place some blame on the individuals is to say that I know that I, as a Treasury official, sought to remove even the appearance of, any kind of a thing that I would do, investment or information I would share in any way, that because you're coming across market sensitive information on a daily basis, and frankly, like, there are ways that you could do it in that no one would ever know. I mean, no one ever knows the information that you get and the things that you hear. So that the personal ethics, I think, that need to go well even beyond what's the minimum required by government ethics officials is necessary. And I think that's where they need to go. Congress should follow suit. And so, you know, what we were talking about here with some of the Fed governors is one thing. Some of the things that we've seen of members of Congress trading in individual names, knowing that they're getting information that is not non-public information, to me just is, really are, pretty huge ethical lapses. And so we need to clean it up everywhere. And there are a lot of costs to go into public service.
Sure.
And that's one of them.
Yeah.
And public service is still incredibly valuable. It's outrageously valuable. Sure. Personally, right? I mean, the opportunity to go do work to help your nation is not a small thing. It's a big thing. Like, you should feel the reward of that, but there are costs too, and those are some of the costs, and you have to just accept it. And and I think most of these guys they're going to be just fine, they're going to be just fine if they are only seeing small growth in their family wealth over the period that they're doing public service.
Yeah, I saw, it was interesting to watch that crisis unfold. And yeah, you're right that there was a lot of attention at Congress, members in both parties, pretty grievously kind of making those unethical trades. And then also there was a big Wall Street Journal investigation about the judiciary. Most of that was related to what spouses were doing and things like that. But there was a lot that came out at the same time. But those were kind of three really big ones that stuck out to me. And the one that ended up making the big change was the Fed. They came out within, I want to say, 6 weeks.
It was pretty quick
that they made those initial changes and then solidified them a couple of months later. But do you think that that side of it, the Fed's communication or reaction to it was appropriate?
Yeah, I do. I think there was a lot of people were pretty offended by what they saw.
Sure.
And I think they understood that they don't, there isn't a great constituency for the Fed. It's not like there are a lot of outside supporters who are going to defend them, protect them. And I think they realize that they're trying to preserve something that is critically important to the economic affairs of the nation, but not well understood by most people. And that is this sense of independence on setting monetary policy. And it's their AAA rating. It's the most important thing for the Fed, is to preserve it so that they can do what's best in the monetary affairs of the United States. They see that, these are aware people. They've got good experience. They have time in Washington. They know the world that they live in. They're not practitioners of politics, but they're alongside it, and they see it, and they know that things can come back to them and hurt them in really significant ways. They saw some of that, just addressing 13-3 powers during global financial crisis, right? Policy mistakes that can be imposed on the Fed are well within possibility. So I think they were frightened and offended by what they saw, and they wanted to clean it up and clean it up quickly. Yeah. And you know, the one favorable condition for them was that this is one of those situations where Congress could not be particularly harsh on them, because they'd be throwing stones from a glass house. So, but they think they recognize it, right? That they do not want to let anything get out of control here and let them focus on their work. But look, there are people who I know and respect who, you know, when I say the Fed has been apolitical, it's a non-political Fed, and I have people who I know and respect who say, what are you talking about? It's very political. And they're talking about things like, you know, the ideological direction on regulation. Again, where Andy Quarles, you know, very good friend of mine, and sure. You know, I know it's a you know, different direction than Dan Turullo.
Sure.
For him, it'll be a different direction with Michael Barr going forward. And so they see that as, well, that's political. And so, well, I'm not talking about regulatory affairs. Like, regulatory affairs are a different matter. You know, Fed independence on setting monetary policy is very, very important and needs to be seen as independent and not affected by personal gain or politics or ideology. It has to be focused on responding to the to economic information that they're seeing, period.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that makes
sense. And fulfilling the mandate. I mean, that's the guiding star for them.
Yeah, but those are the goalposts, exactly. Okay, so then the last topic for today is inflation, and not the, like, you know, them necessarily forecasting wrong or which almost everyone did or not responding. But I want to talk about the communication aspect, things like, you know, their use of the word transitory, which got so much slack because they kind of leaned into it heavy and then slow, kind of walked it back as it became evident that it wasn't going to be transitory, at least on a normal person's definition, probably of a couple of months. But you know, there's this sense of the Fed needs to use, and this word, I think, this diplomacy word that people have been talking about in the news because of Taiwan, this idea of, I'm not sure if I'm even going to get it right, but
destructive ambiguity.
Yes. Or, thank you. The ambiguity. Yeah. And so there's a degree to which the Fed needs to use some of that as well, because they're not going to promise this is what the next six meetings are going to do, because they need to be flexible. They need to be able to, but they also have a significant advantage in their job will be better if people know in general where they're going. So how do they, you know, we can use this inflation as an example if you want, or just in general, you know, how do you balance those things?
Well, I think one of the great challenges for the Fed, especially, I think, is this misunderstanding of, you know, like the sort of the sense of precision in their work, right? I mean, I think there's, you know, I don't think there's enough sense of humility in the job that they have, right? Just you need to be very humble. You know, I say that people who know me, you know, I say this all the time, right? But it takes us three estimates of GDP of the last quarter, right?
The past.
The past. We can't even.
It's already happened. Yeah.
Guess is to predict the past.
Yeah.
Right. And so when you think about the arguments we have over predicting the future, and we know a future that becomes more and more uncertain with every month forward that you're looking, we have to have so much more humility and so much less reliance on the expectation of the precision of what they're telling us. Now, transitory, again, like, you need to be very, if you're going to use a word, you need to explain it. And I know they tried a little bit. You know, like transitory over what is the time horizon we're talking about for transitory? And I think most people would say it was in the 18 to 24 months, not, you know, 8 to 24 weeks. You know, which is kind of what people, at least the political economy world, was thinking about it. And it's just unfortunate. So if you're going to use words, you have a duty to explain them. You have an obligation to yourself so that you're not misunderstood. I have always felt, as a matter of communications, when you are you're trying to say things, you're trying to deliver messages to your a particular audience, and if they're not getting it, it's not their fault.
Right.
If they're not getting it, it's your fault. You're using the wrong words. You're explaining it poorly. You're not thinking about what their base level of knowledge is going into your communication with them. And so it's the Fed's fault if people misunderstood transitively, and you know, because they need to do a better job of communicating it. And so that's a, you know, so I thought that was important, but. And saying up front, these things are hard, right?
Because talking about exactly.
Complex kinds of issues. And, you know, but I do think there would be a useful effort would be to try to explain, you know, some of the uncertainty on this going forward. And that I judge the Fed generally on whether it's directionally correct on certain things, not the precision, because I just, the precision is, it's just really, really hard. And, you know, well, I used to, you know, I would sit around and watch, you know, sometimes even participate in some of the debates over, you know, whether we should raise the, you know, the target, right, from 1.5% to 2% to above 2%. And it's like, you know, how about if we just get it close, you know, let's just get it, which is, you know, you know, they'd be very, very successful to get close in most of what they do. So very successful. And so so it's really hard, but they have to continually get better at communicating on these things. I think they've done a good job of essentially admitting when, you know, they're afraid to admit when they've got it, that they've got it wrong. Yep. I think it's a really important communications tool. And I think it's one of the reasons why Powell in particular has the people have confidence in him, and you know, people in Washington have confidence in him, and market participants seem to trust him as well. It takes, you know, it's hard to admit, you know, if you saw things wrong or you misjudged it. There's no question that they got it wrong. Like, that's not, so that should not be a point of debate.
Sure.
If inflation is running, you know, significantly hotter than the target, by definition, they got it wrong. And we could blame the amount of fiscal support that happened out there, but it's their job to make an assessment of the fiscal support also, and react to it and calibrate their decisions based on that. So they got it wrong, but I think they're dealing with it responsibly. I think they are, you know, in the face of a lot of attacks from, you know, my friend Larry Summers and others, and everyone has opinions on whether they're moving fast enough or at a you know, at the right magnitude. But I think they're in, you know, I think their commitment to defeating inflation is getting through to the market. I think if you look at forward, the market's forward-looking expectations, they seem to think that the Fed is going to defeat inflation. Yeah. So then that's what you want. That's what you want to see. But it's going to take them some time.
Yeah, and I think that humility on that's a huge point there. There's a degree of humility required on both sides. And that allows that adds a little grease. So just
I don't know that I'm not a huge fan of the dot plots, you know. I would be in favor of the Fed talking more expressly and loudly about ranges of outcomes. Going forward, just like to expand the ranges of outcomes so that we can just get off of this expectation on precision and the mythology around precision. It's too hard to be talking about the future with much precision, but you could talk about ranges of outcomes and direction, and I think it'd be very, very helpful to people.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, any last minute in the last minute, any other suggestions or hobby horses that you have about Fed communication, either of the last few years or looking forward?
I do think it's getting so much better. They're communicating a lot more, which is great. I would love to see you know, maybe there isn't a market for it. You know, maybe maybe there isn't a huge market for hearing from Fed governors in more popular press and popular
broader audience kind of stuff.
But I would like to see more. I think the press conferences are really terrific. They're really good. It's such a an excellent press corps. They ask great questions. They're all talented. They're in person. You know, back to being in person now too, which is great. I think that that helps the dynamic. But I would just love to see a lot more of. I would love to have seen Bernanke a lot more. You know, he had to do it in a crisis situation. Powell, and maybe that's the problem. There's only interest when you're in the crisis situation. Otherwise, people don't want to hear from these boring academic Fed governors. But I think they have a lot to teach, and I think it is. It would be really useful if we could find more creative ways for them to reach more audiences, because they do end up teaching really well. And at the end of the day, that's what you really want. You know, you want people to understand what your motivations are, what your goals are, what are the information that you're dealing with, and take the mystery away from it. And I think that that was part of Bernanke's evolution on communications from the Fed generally, was take this mythology away from it and show that there are deliberations and there are views. And we're dealing with complex issues, so talking about explaining and teaching them more will be beneficial. And I think there's just a lot more to do on that. I would love to see a lot more communication. I'd love to see maybe a Fed podcast. Maybe do that's right. They should be coming on with you, Caleb. They should be on the reserve.
That's right.
The central verse? Is that it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, yep. The world of central banking. That's right. Yeah, we need to. I'm looking. I'd be happy to hire. This has been wonderful, and I think that last point is key. And it has a culture of evolution, at least, which I think for a 110 year institution is quite something.
I agree. Well, thanks for having me on. It's been really really wonderful. I love these issues.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So everybody, Tony is at Tony Fratto on Twitter, and his podcast and Hamilton Place Strategies podcast is MacroCast, out every Friday. Until next time, thanks for listening.